and welcome to Thrift Shop Biography. This is the one about Amy Winehouse. Thank you for listening.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. You all right?
No, I'm thoroughly depressed.
Oh.
Because I've just been reading the book about Amy Winehouse that her dad, Mitch, wrote.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, I have as well, but it didn't depress me.
Oh, it didn't?
No, because I knew the ending. I knew it because we lived through it.
Oh, yeah, I know, but you got to hear it from the perspective of the dad.
I didn't find it any different from the newspapers reported, because they were obviously quite accurate, actually, for once.
Yeah, that's because Blake's mum's feeding them all the information for money.
Yeah, the sources were coming from the real people, including the dad. He talked to them all the time.
So were you an Amy Winehouse fan?
Yeah, she's good. I didn't own an album, but she's very good. I saw her at Glastonbury. I was trying to work out when. I think it's about maybe 2007-ish, around there.
Like pre-Beehive or with Beehive?
Ooh, it's hard to pinpoint exactly when. She was definitely famous and she was very thin, tattoos everywhere. Mm-hmm. And she was a mess. She was pulling at her skirt. She was looking down, mumbling through all the songs, and it was really depressing. A total car crash. It was horrible.
Damn it.
Yeah. It is. It's a tragic story of a talented, drug-addled young woman.
Did you know about her dad before reading the book?
Yeah, because he was always talking to the press, and we lived this because she was so big in Britain. It was on our news all the time, wasn't it? He was on our news. He was on morning television talking all the time.
Yeah, I know.
You couldn't avoid him.
I know.
What do you think about her?
I love her. It's so weird to think she only really had two albums in her lifetime.
Yeah, no, I did think there was probably more music that I didn't know about, and there really kind of isn't.
Even after her death, it's not like there were archives to plunder.
No.
It's like she did relatively few tracks, really.
Her dad's saying she got really bored of singing the same songs, and he's like, why don't you write some new ones then?
But no, I loved her. I mean, I got into her with the second album, Back to Black, but because I loved that so much, I went back and listened to Frank.
I think a lot of people must have done that.
Yeah. And wow, they're both brilliant because she is a brilliant artist who I think was at odds with actually being a famous celebrity, but we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But her dad, I was aware of him through his numerous media appearances, and I think he should have backed off a bit, actually. And I think that was probably humiliating for Amy to have her dad. How many other famous people's dads go on the news regularly?
I mean, you'd have been humiliated. She didn't seem that bothered.
Yeah. No, she doesn't seem that bothered in a book written by her dad.
Yes, good point.
This is her dad telling us this story, yeah.
There's one time she's like, Dad, you shouldn't have done that, and it really backfired.
Yeah, of course.
But the rest of it, he just got mad at her and said, I'm trying to protect you.
Yeah, and I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that he is a singer, and in his 20s, he tried to have a singing career, but you know, had to do the responsible thing of earning a living to support his family, which was Amy and her brother. And I think the reason he spent so much time with her is that he lived his own singing dreams vicariously through his daughter. Anyway, let's get into it. Amy Jade Winehouse was born in September 1983 in North London. He actually starts by saying she was 4 days late and nothing ever changed. For the whole of her life, she was always late. I hate it when people are late.
Yeah, I know. No respect for other people's time.
No, I know. She's a nightmare from the day she's born, really. Let's face it. Do you think?
She's definitely a wild person. She's born a wild spirit.
But she undeniably adores her dad.
Yeah.
And that is reciprocated.
Yes.
It really is a lovely relationship. But I think at times possibly too close.
Yeah, I agree. It very much is a relationship.
Yeah.
Actually. I noted that she loves spinning around. She loves the feeling of disorientation. Because I actually think that that's a gateway drug.
Oh, she's making herself dizzy. She's altering her brain
chemistry. Yes, you actually love the feeling of being dizzy and feeling out of it a bit. And if you're spinning around a lot, I'm not going to deny I liked hanging upside down a lot.
Did you?
Yeah. And in the following adult years of doing a bit of this and that, I thought, oh, wow, I wonder if, you know, I always loved the feeling of being upside down. And I think there's got to be a connection.
Yeah, right. Yeah. What, are you saying you're a massive druggie as
well? No, no way. But if you enjoy being altered, your mind being altered.
She also developed this thing where, well, she started choking in public, right? And then her dad had to come to, like, her rescue and stop her from choking.
Yeah, but it was fake.
Was the first time fake?
Maybe not.
Because of the attention that drew to her, she then began fake choking. And she's, what, 3 or 4 at this point?
Yeah.
She's a nightmare.
She is a nightmare. She's a very much an attention-seeking person. And it's one of those textbook contradictory things, because she ends up being terrified of audiences, but craves the attention.
Yeah.
So you're stuck in a dichotomy.
And it must be terrifying if you're the parent of that, because you would never be sure.
You've got to check each one, haven't you?
Yeah. He said eventually they did begin to ignore it and she stopped.
Yeah.
Which just totally proves it was totally for the attention.
Yep. And the hiding thing. Who else hid?
Britney Spears.
That's right. She was a hider.
They hide to get attention.
Yeah, because everyone panics. Where are they? And then they're all looking for you and it's all about you.
Oh, wow. My God. No, don't.
She hid in places like department stores as well, which totally freaked them out.
Yeah. Well, it would.
Just totally mess up your day. Yeah, she was a nightmare. You're right.
Yeah.
But you're right. This man, his whole life has become about his daughter. He had other kids.
Well, he had a boy, Alex, who's older than Amy, who looks just like her, by the way.
Oh, right.
I feel bad for him.
Well, yeah, because she's demanding all the attention. She's actually basically demanding all the love of her dad.
It's interesting because her mum wrote a book as well. Obviously, we read the dad's one. I'm interested now to find her account of things, because he doesn't really mention the mum that much in this book.
No, he doesn't.
They divorced when Amy was 10. And he does mention her a couple of times. And when he does, he's totally respectful about her. I don't think that's kind of the reality.
No, he mostly talked about his new partner, Jane. He fell in love with Jane, right? She was the new marketing manager at his work. He was selling windows. It's the total proper working class people. And he realised he loved her, but he loved her and he loved his wife. He had to try and work out who he loved more. In the end, he picked the new person. You're always going to pick the new thing over the old thing. But the thing is, you've got kids. That should be a deciding factor. If it's equal, the kids should swing it.
Yeah, but you've got an annoying kid who chokes in public and hides and stuff. You'd want some time away from her.
Yeah, but he said once they split up, he ended up spending more time with her and he didn't want time away from her. But anyway, Amy Winehouse proclaimed that she was totally cool with the parents, and at the time she was writing little stories and everything was fine. And then years later, he found all of her lyrics and musings, and she wasn't fine at all with it. Not at all. It did mess her up. She just kept it secret.
By the way, Mitch's mum dated Ronnie Scott.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing.
So this is the jazz influence to Amy is very authentic in the fact that Mitch got it from his mum. So this is generational jazz influence coming down.
Yeah, it's very musical family.
Yeah. So she went out with Ronnie Scott's. Ronnie Scott's, I'm just so used to because it was the venue.
The venue.
She went out with a building.
Yeah.
So she used to date Ronnie Scott. And then Glenn Miller came over in the 1940s and tried to steal her away.
From Ronnie Scott. I know. And Ronnie Scott asked her to marry him.
Yeah.
And then Glenn Miller tried to steal her off him. She said no to both these amazing legends and married an ordinary fellow. Apparently, it says Ronnie Scott mentioned her in his autobiography. Oh, my God, we need to read that.
Yeah, I didn't even know he had one.
No, I didn't ever think of him as a real man.
Because he's a building.
I know, that's weird. He's a venue.
So Amy does have this very clear jazz influence when she's growing up and she's hearing all the old standards or singers like Sarah Vaughan. But also, at the same time, she's really into current bands like TLC and Salt and Pepper. But he also says that her and her friend used to dress up as Pepsi and Shirley.
Oh my God, right? They infiltrate everywhere.
Here they are again. Welcome to the Pepsi and Shirley podcast. Now, what's really weird about that is Amy was born in 1983. Pepsi and Shirley were kind of there then.
Yeah.
And then their career, when they broke away from Wham, was only like 1986.
She'd gone backwards.
She'd gone back in time to Pepsi and Shirley.
Yeah. But she's going to be a music aficionado, isn't she?
Yeah, she's going to know her stuff.
Dug deep.
Yeah.
Oh, she knows. You can that definitely comes through in her voice.
What, the Pepsi and Shirley influence?
Yeah. The soul of Pepsi and Shirley. Yeah, all the dad side of the family were real EastEnders, real big Jewish family, very family-oriented.
Which is why I think she's so close to her dad and he's so close to her.
Yeah, I guess that's the case. But we don't know anything about the mother because he just doesn't mention her.
Yeah. There's a photo in this book. My God, she looks just like Amy. Yeah. I think she's smiling on their wedding day. I think it might be that one.
Yeah.
The mouth and the nose and everything. It's pure Amy Winehouse. Yeah. But I think she's equally close to her mum as well, because when she accepted the Grammys, she calls her mum up and they're hugging on stage. So she's obviously close to her mum.
Right. I'm only really aware of her dad.
So Amy also loved the old black and white musicals, Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly. Great. Loved all that.
Yeah.
When she's, you know, getting to be 9 or 10, she's wanting to go to a performing arts school and she pleads with her parents to let her go. And she does, because she's into like musical theatre at this point. And then because of Fred Astaire, she wants to learn tap dancing and stuff. Mm. So I don't imagine Amy White has to be musical theatre or tap dancing.
Yeah, it's weird. When you see pictures of her young, and I have been looking, younger, she looks cool. She's definitely got an edge. But she is a normal person. She turned herself into an icon.
Yeah, and I think as well, when I look at those pictures of her as a child, when you think of a stage school brat, you think of the very blonde, very pretty people like Emma Bunt and Denise Van Outen.
Yeah, all singing or dancing.
Yeah, almost like they make carbon copies of people. So yeah. Amy Winehouse is really unusual looking. And you kind of think that she might be overlooked at a performing arts school for children. But actually the staff really liked her and embraced her, but even though she was just so naughty at school.
Yeah.
Like, she was a real problem child.
Yes.
For everyone.
Every time she got sent to the headmaster's office, she'd sing Fly Me to the Moon all the way there. And she's just singing all the time.
They were picking up on her voice, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, her voice.
Even as a child.
I'm sure she's really nice as well. I bet she was really nice to talk to, really personable.
No, I totally get that. A lot of the time, and from what I know, obviously being around here, in the pubs in Camden,
like
she would literally talk to anyone.
Yeah.
She's really open and she's funny and she's charming. Yeah, she's totally open to people and inviting people in, which I think might have been a lot of her problem later on. Because I think that when the drugs kicked in, you do get lots of people hanging around. She was never closed off to anyone.
Mm.
That part of her personality might have made that situation worse.
Yeah, that's possible.
Because those people do find a way of getting in.
So her dad spent his whole life throwing everyone out.
I loved reading that, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, so she was 12 when she applied herself to go to the Sylvia Young School. She managed to get that application and send it off without them even knowing and got accepted at 12. And she was a lot of trouble there. She was in a lot of trouble for jewellery, nose rings, all that stuff you weren't. But I mean, she didn't have any tattoos then, obviously. But she already had nose rings and piercing. And at some point it says she was working at a fetish market stall in Camden. I think she was pretty young when she was doing that, you know. Camden became her soul sanctuary, didn't it? It's where she belongs. It's where all the misfits go in its music, but it's like punk, goth, alternative music people.
And she's still there to this day.
She's still there. Is she married there?
There's a statue of her in Camden Market.
Is there really?
Yeah. And there's a couple of like street art murals and stuff.
Oh,
she's
very
much Camden.
Yeah, there's a lot of T-shirts and...
Yeah, if you go to Camden and walk through it, you don't go very far until you see another image of Amy on a wall or whatever. Yeah. They really embrace her. She's like Camden's daughter.
That's really true. I mean, she only died in 2011. You sort of felt that if you went to Camden, you might well see Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
It was in the papers what pubs she was in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she never left.
She almost, to that extent, lived the life of a normal person.
She did,
even
actually.
With extreme global fame. Most people retreat.
Yeah.
Kind of, you don't see them out and about. She'd always just be sat in the pub.
Yeah, that's right.
Among normal people and hanging out with normal people. Yeah.
I guess that's why she's the hero of Camden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's at Sylvia Young's and she's getting little bits of work here and there. And she's on The Far Show, which is a sketch show comedy on TV. That clip is on YouTube if you want to watch it. She's also getting parts in Don Quixote at the Coliseum. And then her dad says, and also a really boring play about Mormons at the Hampstead Theatre. So she is getting little bits of work as a jobbing child actor here and there. Again, it's weird. Because she came out as such an authentic musician, it's hard to marry that with the fact that she was a stage school child at some point.
Well, she was an authentic musician's soul that knew they needed a bit of training.
Yeah.
That's all. But yeah, they sort of let her go at 15 because they said, look, she's not going to get her GCSEs here. She's going to fail. She's brilliant at the music, but she's not paying any attention to any of the other subjects. And they basically said, if you want her to get her GCSEs, we recommend you make her go through a normal school because then she'll have to focus. The dad says it sort of, everyone says she was kicked out and she wasn't. They just sort of asked her to leave. Well, they knew it was better for her. So she went to a normal school, which had a great music teacher. So she actually still had her music, but she did get some qualifications by the time she's 16. Then she's free to roam. She went to the Brit School at 16.
Lots of people have come
Adele went there.
Adele, Leona Lewis, Rizzle Kicks. Jessie J.
Yeah.
Loads of people who are technically very brilliant. I'm not including Rizzle Kicks in this, although I don't know. Perhaps Rizzle Kicks are. It's just from their music. You don't get that. But all this, like Leona Lewis, Jessie J, Adele, Amy Winehouse, possibly four of the most outstanding singers Britain has produced in the last 20 years, all came through the Brit School.
Yeah, that's impressive.
They either only take on really talented people or they're really good.
Yeah, or it's just a coincidence.
Oh, okay.
Because maybe there's loads of others have come from the other school.
Oh.
Anyway, well done, Brit School. You made this. No, she was already amazing.
Yeah, she was already amazing insofar that long after she'd left the Sylvia Young School, Sylvia Young got back in touch with them and said the National Youth Jazz Orchestra would be great for Amy. You should get her to audition. So Mitch phoned them up and actually said, well, we don't do auditions. Just send her along. And of course, this 16-year-old girl with the voice of a 19-year-old.
Yeah.
They love her. And it wasn't long before she was actually fronting the orchestra, like singing.
Yeah. And they made recordings of her singing with the orchestra, which she then used to basically get herself an audition with this company called Brilliant.
Yeah. What happened is her friend, Tyler, who was another soul singer, had listened to the tape of her singing with the National Youth Jazz Orchestra and said, this is amazing. Now, he had a manager. And so he said to his manager, you need to come and see this 16-year-old girl singer. And the manager's only like 19.
Yeah.
So he went and said Amy was really standoffish. Like, she didn't want a manager. She wasn't even that interested in having a pop career. So she just wanted to sing the music. It was all about the music. And through this book, we learn actually it was. She's more of a old head musician than a pop star.
Yeah, so actually, if she just managed to scrape a living going around the club singing, her band she'd put together was all 60 to 70-year-old men. If she'd managed to just make a small living, not being famous, but just going around singing the band and scraping enough money together to have a fun life in Camden, she would have been all right.
She would have been all right, but I just think that voice would ever have just been allowed to exist on that level. At some point, the managers would always have honed in on it and they would always have said to her, let's put you in.
I think you're right. And it's not just the voice, it's the way she uses it, the way she phrases it, you know. It's literally like she's channeling all the greats.
Yeah.
It's proper jazz.
You can listen to her singing the same song live 20 times and it is never the same.
No, because that's jazz for you. She really is. It's the soul is coming out.
And she's doing that at the age of 16.
Yeah.
It's like it's just in her.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up listening to jazz. I could never.
You're named after a jazz legend.
Cleo Lane, I am. Grew up on jazz and none of that made me into an amazing singer or performer or... I can't, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's her
in
blood.
Her.
Yeah.
It's a gift from God.
Yeah. No.
It's just biology.
It's nature.
It's nature.
Yeah.
So then this guy, Nick Szymanski, who is with the PR agency Brilliant, sees her and is blown away.
Yeah, that company Brilliant got bought up by Simon Fuller and got absorbed into 19. But they were the manager of the Spice Girls, weren't they?
Yes, they were. When, like years ago, when I found out that Amy Winehouse was signed by 19, you're kind of like, that just doesn't seem to fit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they just seem like a massive pop agency.
And that's right, it didn't fit.
But then you find out that they actually had Annie Lennox on their books as
well. Yeah, but she's pop.
Okay,
amazing soulful voice again, but still pop music.
So she signs with 19.
Yeah. By the way, she had a proper relationship with this bloke called Chris Taylor, who was a journalist, properly in love, 9 months. The breakup formed the lyrics to Frank. Mm-hmm. She has to have gone through some torment to write some songs, and that's what she did. And then almost as soon as she recorded it, it reminded her too much of the misery, and she didn't want to sing them. And the same happened in Back to Black, because that was all about the next misery. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to write the songs about the pain, then she doesn't want to sing them because it makes her sad.
Yeah, I kind of get that because like we just said, she's feeling it. It's coming from within
really
her.
Really feeling it,
It's not, she's not just getting on and parroting the same thing over and over again. She's literally channeling the emotion to sing the song in the way that like Sinead O'Connor would.
Yes.
You know, it's real. So she's not just getting on stage and singing Back to Black. She's getting on stage and she's connecting to the emotions of the time and space when she wrote it.
Which is miserable every time.
Yeah.
She can only write from misery and pain.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Sure is.
Yeah.
She's still under 18 at this point, by the way, so her mum and dad have to go and sign the management contract with her.
Yeah, she signs a publishing deal at first. She's had different deals. It's a publishing deal at EMI. Mm-hmm. She got $250,000 for that.
Yeah. And they put her in touch with a producer called Salam Remy, who had been working with the Fugees.
Yeah.
So, of course, Amy is like, she loved Salt and Pepper, TLC, Pepsi and Shirley. So the Fugees is like right up her street.
Yeah.
So she's getting to do her jazzy songs, but with that real urban hip-hop.
Taking it into the time, which is about 2002-ish, which is perfect.
What I found interesting is that she had this publishing deal and she had the PR deal with Brilliant. They recorded most of the Frank album. She still didn't have a record deal.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So they had this amazing talent, worked with brilliant people, and they probably thought, let's get it all together first. She was doing live gigs. She was getting known on the London club circuit, but only playing small bars and stuff. So they really allowed her to do loads of live performances, write her album, and then they went shopping the tape around. And then, of course, everybody wanted her.
Mm.
And then it was Island Records who got her.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect label for her, actually, when you think about the other people they have on the roster.
Definitely.
I didn't get into Frank until after Back to Black. I thought it's because Frank wasn't made for the mainstream. It wasn't as accessible. It wasn't as hook-laden. It was more about the voice and the music. Mm-hmm. And so unless you were really into that type of music, you might not necessarily have heard it. It wasn't being played on the radio loads. But then Back to Black, obviously, is the pop masterpiece. Mm-hmm. I think that was probably deliberate in itself. They don't launch her, even when she has initial UK success, they don't launch her into the US straight away because they said it's not time yet.
They also said her performance wasn't ready because she was playing the guitar. Oh, yeah. She was always looking down at the strings and she didn't connect with people. So they had to hone her act before they launched her there.
All those early footage of Amy Winehouse, she plays the guitar. And of course, you forget that's how she started because she wrote all of her songs are written on an acoustic guitar.
That's right.
Yeah. Island also gave her $250,000. So she's in the money, but that's only record company advance until they've made their money back and she can start getting royalties.
And so her dad steps in and takes control of her money straight away because he knows she'll fritter it away.
And she knows that herself. So
she knows. Really she aware. Agrees with that. She's renting a flat in East Finchley with a friend. After not long, her dad gets it all together to buy her a flat in Camden where they've put a certain amount of money down as down payment, but it's still a mortgage. So it's really carefully managed her life. Mm-hmm. She's on an allowance. She can't get out a lot of money unless there's four signatures on it. Very sensible. Every attempt is made to keep her on the straight and narrow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this woman's life has been managed by her manager, by her PR guy, by her friends, by her family, and it still massively went off.
She still messed it up. I know, because her dad says a few times, people would say, how did you let this happen to your daughter? And when you read this book, you realise that
it's a hopeless situation.
It's hopeless, and actually, you couldn't have done more
to help her.
You could not have done more, given her more love and support.
He does say that when she first got her flat and she moved into it with her friend, he went round and he noticed there were a couple of joints in the ashtray.
Yeah, he went mad at weed.
Yeah, because I guess he had no real experience with drugs and he didn't think that Amy did. So I think that's a big deal, actually.
Yeah.
She's still young.
It's completely anti-drugs and ignorant about everything. When you think the journey he had to go on.
Oh, and that's why I don't judge him too harshly with this, because it's kind of like he all of this is a baptism of fire for the poor man.
Yes, just an ordinary bloke.
Yeah, and it's all of a sudden his daughter is progressing to become a heroin addict. I mean, how do you do? Nobody knows how to deal with that if you've not gone through it before.
Yeah, and it's very telling. He can't even deal with weed.
Yeah.
So he really had to learn some harsh lessons of life. Mm-hmm. He became an expert, basically, on addiction, didn't he?
Well,
by the end of the book, he's saying, it's an illness, I get it now.
Yeah, he would go on TV and talk about it and embarrass Amy. So she's recorded her album's ready by the time she's signed to Island. They put a single out, Stronger Than Me, and it kind of stiffs, only gets to number 71. But as we know, Wham Rap stiffed when it first came out. It's okay. But,
as long as they're not diddled, it's fine.
They can be stiffed and not diddled. Yes. Everything is all right. But then a couple of weeks later, the album comes out and enough of a buzz has circulated that actually the album does sell well.
It gets to number 13. Yeah, that's not bad. And it's shortlisted for a Mercury Music Award and two Brit Awards.
Yeah.
That's actually great.
They're voted for by the industry. So that goes to show that even though sales aren't happening yet, the industry has really recognised her talent.
It's respected,
And she does Glastonbury and V Festival. This is before the Beehive, so she's different altogether on stage. So she's doing bigger gigs and stuff, and then she gets the Ivor Novello Award for Best Contemporary Song.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, she started to drink more. Everyone was worried about her drinking. But her dad said, I think she's fine. And that ended up in a song.
Yeah.
Which kind of haunted him for the rest of his life.
Bet.
My daddy thinks I'm fine. They tried to make me go to rehab. I said, no, no, no.
No, no, no.
And he says now he hears it everywhere he goes.
I hate the fact that the woman who wrote this brilliant song about not going to rehab just should have gone and stayed there. I mean, she died a few years later because she didn't.
I know, but she said she'd go and then she actually went. But when she got there, they said they were going to keep her there for 2 months and she had too much to do. She didn't want to go there for 2 months. She thought it'd just be a few days. So she was out in 3 hours or something.
Well, this is when the first album was out and doing really well.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you've got to go to rehab for 2 months.
10 months?
Well,
not going to happen. Yeah. No, you could see that.
It's interesting, actually, because I was surprised that this early in her career that the managers got together with her dad to talk about Amy's drinking problem. I'm surprised that this early on it's recognised as a thing. Because I thought it all happened when she met Blake.
That's true. So she was already weed smoking and a party girl.
Yeah.
So her character was leading that way.
I would say more than a party girl. If her manager's talking about her drinking. No, hang on. No, they have £500,000 invested in this woman.
Yeah.
It's like George Michael. Remember at the end, they wouldn't even let his friends visit. And if
That's
they did,
true.
They said to him, don't take him out. And George Michael's like, I can go out for a drink. But because so much money was riding on one person, it's almost like they don't want them to drink at all.
Yeah. Anyway, the worst thing, by the way, her nan died, which devastated all of them. Oh, I love her nan's last words. I've had enough.
Yes.
I want them to be my last words.
I love that as well. I think that's a real sane decision.
Yeah.
Just to get to be like 80 something and then just go, oh, I've had enough.
I've had enough.
Yep.
Brilliant, nice one, Nan. Although they were very upset.
So the first album sold really well, sold 300,000 copies in the UK. And like Mitch says, at that point, you would think, oh, her career's got off to a really good start. But actually, it started to plateau and nothing happened. And the record company said, come on, it's time for you to write your second album.
And that's why they don't like the drinking, because they can't see any productivity.
But because Amy is a true artist and she works and speaks from the heart, she can't write a new album until she's had the experiences that will create that new album.
So what does she do? She meets a total loser called Blake Fielder Civil, which her dad calls a low-life scumbag. But the thing is, he was 20 and he was a drug addict, a heroin addict, did coke and a bit of heroin. He was just a total mess. And they fell in love the day they met. That's not love, it's lust.
She had his name tattooed on
within
her breast within a month of meeting him.
Yeah, so they thought it was love. They were all loved up in some illusionary haze of apparent love.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because it's kind of like people say, oh, he wormed his way in and got her hooked on drugs and stuff. But I think at this moment in time when they meet, there's just an obvious chemistry,
instant
an connection.
Yeah.
Amy's fallen head over heels in love. I don't think he needed to wheedle his way in because she'd fallen for
him.
Oh,
no. Yeah, something just clicked. But he already had a girlfriend. Mm. So then a month later, he says he's left her. Then they're together. Then he hasn't left his girlfriend. So they split up. Then Amy goes to Spain with her dad and his girlfriend. And, they're having a nice holiday for a few days and they buy her a guitar. And she spends the rest of the holiday writing some of those legendary songs that are in Back to Black. And also on the phone to Blake the entire time and basically barely leaves the room for the rest of the holiday.
Yeah.
But she's written some corking songs in that time.
Oh, I think some of the best songs in history have been born out of these terrible experiences.
Yeah, in some hotel room in Spain.
So they get back to go. I mean, here's the thing. For the interest of this podcast, let's just say the remainder of it. She's in and out of love with Blake. They're forever going out and splitting up. Same with rehab. She's forever going in and going out. So we're going to mess up the chronological.
Oh, my God. It is literally. Then she had a seizure. Then she was in hospital. Then she says, oh, Dad, I'm never going to touch drugs again. This time I mean it. 3 days later. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
5 days later, back in rehab, and it literally does. It goes back and forth right up to her death.
Yeah.
She has enough near experiences with death. By the time she dies, it isn't surprising when you read this book. It's very sad, but it isn't surprising.
You know those early gigs she did for Frank? She would come out before she even started singing and she would start to chant, "Class A drugs are for mugs." So that's how she felt about coke and heroin, which is surprising. It's just that thing. It's just that meeting. If she only she didn't meet Blake. But then if only she didn't meet Blake, we'd never have Back to Black.
I know.
So in a way, she had to die for the amazing art.
I mean, she died at 27 and she joins that long list of legendary people who died at 27. And they are some of the greatest talents ever. And it does seem like that whole group of people are tortured souls and the torture makes the best art. It's just one of those things.
I think a lot of good art is made by people who live long lives.
Yeah, there's that as well, definitely. There definitely is, but she's in the other group.
And there are a lot of people who died at 27 who made shit art.
Yeah, or didn't make any.
But didn't make any.
Yeah, that's very true.
At least she made some art.
It's weird, the 27 number, though, isn't it?
So at this time that she met Blake, her friend Tyler and her manager Nick Szymanski both said they noticed an immediate change in Amy. The day she met Blake, they can draw a line. She fundamentally changed as a person. And also when they would go around and visit, they didn't know she was on heroin at this point, but they said all of a sudden it was like she shifted and she almost wasn't there when you spoke to her.
Yeah.
So quite quickly, getting together with Blake, things started working on a downward trajectory.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's him who got her into it.
But, I mean, who is this bloke? He was just like a video production runner. He come from up north, right? His parents were...
I mean, it ends up being like some sort of fight with the neighbours over the fence in the garden. Oh, yeah, it's like that sort of stuff. But it all played out in the press.
Yeah.
It's so embarrassing. And we lived through this. So it was like Blake's parents were going, "You shouldn't buy Amy Winehouse's records. She's a drug addict. She's turned our son onto drugs." It was like, wow, no, it was the other way around, actually. That's why the stories were so accurate, like we said at the beginning.
Yeah,
because they were feeding the papers.
It's that interesting thing where they think their son can do no wrong. So they're blaming Amy for his drug problem. And Mitch thinks that Blake is a scumbag and the worst. The fact is they're both adults and they're both,
Do you know what? You're right. If it wasn't Blake, it would have been someone else, because that is where she was heading, I sadly think.
Well, she was an addict at that point because she was with the drinking problem.
She's got the character and she was with those people and that's the world that she kind of was immersed in. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
So the parents fight it out in public and we all get to know a hell of a lot more than we should about these people.
Also, I think initially Blake's parents weren't so supportive, didn't work with Mitch as much to get them help. Amy and Blake didn't want help in the beginning. They'd go to rehab for a day and they would leave. And like Mitch said, Blake actually said to his face, "I'm doing rehab for Amy because I've got no intention of giving up drugs because I like being a drug addict."
Exactly.
I mean, that's the key thing, isn't it?
And that's the voice she'll be hearing all the time as well.
Yeah. I mean, you can take somebody to rehab as many times as you want until they decide for themselves they want to give up.
Yeah.
They won't. And I think as well, Blake's parents, obviously, he's not married to Amy at this point. She's a massively famous person. It's their link to fame. It's their link to money, don't you think?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Then I don't know what their motivation is then.
I don't either.
It's his mum, but it's his stepdad. He's headmaster of a school, and you think, how can they behave like this in the press?
I think it's total denial that their son isn't perfect, you know.
Yeah.
It was reported that his mum hit someone in the face.
Yeah, it was at a school sports day. I don't know if it's the school where his stepdad was a headmaster, but it was reported in the newspapers that she hit someone in the face and she had her car keys in her hand.
Uh-oh.
I mean, who does that kind of thing anyway?
Yeah, it's that proper cartoon behaviour, isn't it? It's really great news if you're a newspaper person.
Yeah.
It just seemed like stories at the time. You read this and realise it's real, but they're messed up people.
You kind of think
really messed up.
Amy and Blake are probably in a hotel somewhere doing coke and heroin, and then they have to sit there keeping to themselves.
Yeah.
And it's mums and dads in the news.
Oh, my God.
How embarrassing.
They got married at some point. They just went and eloped. I remember it all. When I'm reading this, I remember it all happening because Blake got done for general bodily harm.
Grievous.
Okay, grievous. It was generally
quite like general bodily harm.
Some grievous bodily harm. And anyway, he gets done. He got 27 months in prison. I think the whole country, anyway, at this point, were rooting for him to get put away because we all thought he was bringing her down, which he was, really.
He
Although
was,
it's but also her responsibility as well.
It is that thing, he got sent to prison, you kind of think, oh, brilliant, this is going to get her away from him. But actually, their love affair is beyond that. He's in her heart. It actually doesn't matter that they're not together, because the fact that he's in prison actually probably makes her love him more.
Oh, God. And her dad says he was on the phone to her all the time, and he doesn't get it. If you've watched prison dramas, you have to queue up for the phone. You get 20 minutes and someone hits you.
Yes.
And he was on the phone to her all the time. Which is weird, isn't it?
Maybe he smuggled in a mobile phone up his bum hole.
Oh, yeah, do that in prison dramas. That's very likely.
So, after the initial success and things were plateauing, the record company were on to her to start recording a new album. But she didn't seem that bothered about ticking it along. And the thing I take from this book is that Amy Winehouse is this amazing talent. She's an artist and she's not motivated by record sales and fame. But now she has a recording contract. Obviously, the record label, that is their business. They do want record sales and fame. So they're pushing her to make an album. And she's actually being really standoffish with them, saying, well, I'm not ready yet. To the point when I was at the beginning of this book and I was reading it, I'm like, what's wrong with the woman? Why doesn't she want to record her music and become a worldwide star?
Weirdly, though, when she does record and it's released and it's a hit, she's really happy and excited.
But she does have stage fright. Her dad says, and I think this nails her actually, she's a really good singer and she loves singing, but she doesn't love performing. And I think when you watch her, especially those awful car crash gigs. It's like she actually doesn't want to be there. It's like she's fulfilling her obligation that the record company are making her do to sell more albums. But she doesn't look comfortable a lot of the time.
Oh, God, no. And he says she often turns her back to the audience. Yeah. Well, that would have been fair enough. I would have taken seeing her, if she was really on fire, with her back to us, better than seeing what I saw.
People say, you know, those awful performances, which unfortunately are still on YouTube, where she's doing a concert, clearly inebriated. I think some of that is because she has to have a couple of drinks to get on stage because she is uncomfortable about performing. I think she would have always been much happier singing in these little dive bars.
Yeah, I agree.
Was it at the funeral or a wedding where she was asked to sing and then she couldn't do it, so she went into another room with the microphone?
That's right. Yeah. It was her nan's funeral.
Right, yes, it was. So even that would show that even in a small setting, so the key to her, she should have got everybody in an arena. She should have stayed in her dressing room and beamed it on screen.
Yeah, that would have worked. She'd have been all right.
Yeah. God damn.
Unless she was wrecked and then that still wouldn't have been all right.
Yeah.
Anyway, all sorts of stuff happened. She did break America.
Well, she worked with Mark Ronson,
That's what did it.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And they were walking around New York and she was telling him about the whole rehab story. They tried to make me go and I wouldn't go. He's like, you should write that into a song. And she'd already actually written it down, but that's what prompted it to be written. And I think it was done by the end of the day or something crazy like that.
And of course, he got the Dap Kings in to be her backing band. That whole thing, the iconic version of Amy that we know with the beehive and the rose and the little dress and that amazing band behind her, that's the Dap Kings. Yeah. I mean, you can't fail with Mark Ronson producing.
Yeah, he's a genius.
Yeah.
A really great combo.
Rehab is the only track on Back to Black that is not about Blake.
Oh, my God.
That's why she doesn't like singing it. So actually, also, she doesn't just have stage fright. She's also having to get on stage and sing songs and revisit her pain.
That's right.
Ah, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, she's a very troubled soul. It's weird because, you know, your Billie Holidays and people are legendary to us. But when you've lived through the life of somebody, she seems so accessible and real to me that I don't see her in the same level as your Billie Holidays, but also I suppose she was channeling them. She did make it her own to a point, but she's very much channeling the legends, whereas those legends invented something brand new. So she's derivative, I might dare I say that.
All white music artists are derivative, aren't they? Black people started it, white people ripped them all off. Isn't that what Amy Winehouse is doing? She's Elvis to a certain extent, isn't she?
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I mean, doesn't mean she's not good. I'm wondering if she's not perceived as an icon by our generation because we saw her literally in the tabloids every single day. Maybe if we were alive at the time of Billie Holiday, would she have been in the equivalent of the tabloids every single day with a drug problem?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I can't explain it.
I wonder if young people who weren't aware enough to have seen Amy in the tabloids every day view her differently than we do.
I think they probably do. I think it's because she's such a contemporary. She's a little bit younger than us too. I actually do really think that it's because she was copying things that went before so much. I rate her less because of that. People might really slap me for saying that.
Oh, do you know what? I don't rate her less. I think she very much stands shoulder to shoulder with Billie Holiday, etc.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think she's that good.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, Tony Bennett sang with her and he absolutely loved her. Prince got her up to sing when he was playing at the O2. People really did rate her. They really, really did.
So, Back to Black sells 20 million copies worldwide.
Yeah.
She's iconic.
Oh, do you know what as well? I've got to give her credit for being a songwriter because she did write those songs and they are absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
All right, I'll give her that. Carry on.
She does get another... Her and Blake are so on-off that she does get another boyfriend called Alex for like a year and a bit.
Yeah.
But then she keeps going back to Blake. She just has this undeniable pull.
Go back to Blake.
Yeah, there you go. I bet she wanted to call it that. I was watching a video of her. She was doing Glastonbury or something. And when Blake's in prison and she has this heart in her beehive and it says Blake on it.
I remember
she,
that.
Yeah, and she would reference him. She would talk about him on stage and
all the
stuff.
Time. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Never shut up about him.
And, you know, so at this time, because she is now a national commodity, the Paps have got free rein on her and they don't leave her alone. And obviously she's not having nice times. She's sometimes arguing with Blake and running down the street crying. I remember seeing those
too.
Awful bits. Mitch says something in here which didn't occur to me because it's awful enough for us to walk into a newsagent's and see Amy Winehouse on the front of the paper, distraught, running down the road. Mitch said he would wake up and see pictures of his daughter, who he's already worried about, and then he's waking up being presented with a picture of her in the worst possible state on the front of a national newspaper. Nobody is prepared to deal with that.
No, I know. And he does say, I totally neglected my wife and my other kids and everything because I just had to be there to check on Amy. I couldn't even go on holiday in case anything happened to her. He was a taxi driver at that point, and he was really was trying to earn a living. He wasn't rolling in the money, and he was doing jobs and then driving by to visit her and check on her and throwing out drug dealers and punching them and all the time. Constantly worried that he was going to get that call that she'd died.
Yeah. The good thing about him being a taxi driver, though, is quite often when she's rushed to hospital, he's not far away.
No, he's really not, yeah.
He says that the first time she has a proper seizure and she's rushed to hospital, Blake is there. By the time Mitch arrives, Blake has gone. Blake is in the papers the next day, turning up with a big bunch of flowers. But actually, he never took them to her on the ward. That's weird. That's like it was just done for the benefit of the Paps.
Yeah.
Or unless he is just a bit scared of Mitch because Mitch has been...
Yeah, that could well be the case.
I love that Mitch went around there one day and found Blake there and he said he kicked him up the arse.
Yeah,
He fell down the steps. Actually, part of me loves that Mitch Winehouse is physically kicking Blake Civil Fielder up the arse.
And then he heard Amy not long later on the phone go, yeah, my dad kicked him up the arse.
He deserves a good kick up the arse.
Yeah, he did, actually, Because also, he was really playing it. He was messaging saying, yeah, I want a divorce. If I leave Amy, will you buy me a house? And then saying on the news, I love Amy, we're not getting divorced. And, you know, and she didn't believe anything bad about him. And eventually Mitch had to show her the texts for her to really believe that he was playing. He was playing her.
Dear.
So that helped because they did get divorced. And she, by the end of her life, had this really nice bloke, didn't she? He was like 50 looking.
Yeah, he's cool. He's very handsome.
He's cool. He was like some sort of film bloke.
Yeah, he's a film director.
Yeah, and he was handsome. He had a quiffy, looked really 50s. Yeah. He went together. He had his life together. And you actually thought, this is great. She's got a normal boyfriend. He seems really... Do you remember when it happened? You're like rooting for her. Look, she might be okay.
Yeah.
She's got a grounding man in her life. And it turns out she really wanted kids. She really wanted to be mother. And he said that might have saved her if she had.
Yeah. When she's with Reg, she's still phoning Blake and they're still... See, you think about addiction. She was addicted to drink before she met Blake, and then she gets addicted to drugs. Actually, she's addicted to Blake.
That's absolutely right.
She can't leave him alone.
The dad says that at some point.
Yeah.
That is the third addiction.
Which makes it so hopeless.
Yeah.
When she's with Reg, this lovely new man, she's still in touch with Blake. Blake is tapping her for money the whole time. Amy sends Blake a postal order for £200. I think that's so funny, a postal order. And Reg said to Mitch that that was on the condition that Amy did not speak to Blake again. And they said they believe that is the last time they ever spoke, which is a good couple of years before she died, right?
Yeah.
So they did eventually split up for good.
Yeah, it seems like they might have. But yeah, in that 2 years, she got off heroin and she started to really see that he was just a hopeless heroin addict when she got off heroin finally. Of course, she took up drinking to such an extent. She just swapped one drug for another, one problem for another. They had to keep cancelling tours because she was so drunk. She was slurring, forgetting the words. She was a total mess. I thought all that twitching was heroin, though, at the time.
Did you? I thought it was kind of more nerves and discomfort.
Maybe.
I mean, it could be.
It was hard to know. You just saw a really messed up person, basically. Yeah. But she also probably had bulimia, by the way. She couldn't eat. She was very, very thin. Bulimia is not mentioned in this book, but I just happened to see that on Wikipedia. It said her brother believed she had bulimia. We do know that bulimics really hide it well.
Yeah.
So it's probably the case. But she was really, really trying. Her dad actually says very strongly that she wanted to get well. And that's half the battle. It was most of the battle. The drinking kept coming back in binges, but then stopped. And it was actually getting to be that she had quite a lot of patches where she wasn't drinking. But of course, that's what eventually killed her. Because if your body, you know, is getting clean, then you have a binge. That's what can kill you. And of course, she broke in America, but she couldn't tour there because of being convicted for drugs. And she could never, ever pass the drugs test. She was never clean for long enough.
I know. That's why she did the Grammys by satellite. Because she knew she was going. She knew she'd been nominated for Grammys. It was like the biggest night of her career. And even with that knowledge, she still couldn't stay off drugs long enough even to take the drug test, which would get her into America.
Yeah.
She was a hopeless case.
Yeah.
So she's drinking a lot. And her doctor has even got to the point where she won't deal with her anymore because she said she's not taking any of my advice and she's going to die. The doctor writes a letter to Mitch basically saying, I'm not going to look after Amy anymore because she never takes her advice. Amy is in immediate danger of death. She was in a coma on the 17th of May and less than 24 hours later, against medical advice, she had discharged herself from the clinic and then just continued drinking. She basically said, if Amy doesn't stop drinking, she's going to die. If she continues her current lifestyle, she'll be dead within 3 months.
Yeah.
Wow. It is odd that her dad does say a lot. He'd go and visit her because her security said she's completely incoherent, she's going crazy, she's cutting herself. And her dad would go over there, see her in this terrible state. And then she would wake up the next morning, seemingly as if nothing had happened. And he couldn't believe how she bounced back each time. Mm. It was almost like she hadn't been drinking. So she did have quite a lot of resilience. Because the weird thing is as well, they were cancelled gigs. Like these last couple of gigs was just awful in East Europe.
Bad, yeah.
But then she'd do a gig the next day and she'd be really on form. It was a really weird roller coaster of her being completely off her face and incoherent and then being great again.
By the way, when she died, it was in the papers, obviously, and they kept putting her address in the papers and they had built some sort of shrine and all the fans had turned up and left things. Maybe about 4 days later, and I had a friend come over from America and we were going to Camden anyway to go to the market, you know, it's a great thing to do. And we said, should we go and look at Amy Winehouse's house. We're like, is that a bit weird? We're like, do you know, well, let's just do it because we'll regret it if we don't. And we did. We just walked over there, stood outside, saw all the candles and all the cards, flowers. There's a few people milling about. And it was actually really emotional. And her car was parked outside the house. Just staring at that car really made it so real. It's like, wow, that person just drove there, parked there and went in and that they never came out. Bloody sad.
One thing this book does is just show you how traumatic it is being the parent of an addict.
That's very true. Devastatingly sad. Poor fellow. And he's dedicated his whole life to the Amy Winehouse Foundation now. Spreading the information of addiction. You know, even just writing that book is just, this can happen to your kid.
Yeah.
You know, it's this after this after this, and you can do all you can, but...
I mean, what can you do as a parent to a child who kind of is a hopeless case? So it's an awful thing to say, but she was, really.
He couldn't have done more. From what he seems to tell us, you couldn't have done more.
I wondered whether he could have done more by doing less at one point. Yeah. He seemed to always be there, but I think instinctively you would want to be.
I know what you mean, but I can't judge him at all.
I don't judge him. No, you can't judge him because this is his first time doing this. He doesn't know what to do.
No idea.
He's getting her all of the medical help available. That's the one thing about her. At the end stage, they had the money, so she could go to rehab as many times as she wanted, go to the clinic, the best medical advice, still didn't save her.
He said she started treating the hospital a bit like a hotel. Yeah. She'd go and have a binge on whatever and then check herself back in.
It's a Matthew Perry thing. It's the thing about having so much money that going to rehab, you can afford it. So you come out and then you think, oh, do you know what? I could just do it once more and then I can go back into rehab.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know.
All right.
Weirdly, because she's such a famous death, I've always felt it was unclear about how she actually died, because people know her as this famous heroin addict. Actually, she hadn't done drugs for about 2 years. It literally was the amount of alcohol found in her blood.
It's alcoholism that killed her. And you always think it's drugs.
She had 416 milligrams of alcohol in her blood. A fatal dose is 350. But people who'd left her the night before say she wasn't drinking. So somehow at night she'd gone home on her own and drunk quite a lot of alcohol.
Oh, yeah. Probably a bottle of vodka or something, wouldn't it be? Yeah, I know.
Bloody hell.
Yes.
Anyway, like I said at the beginning, I'm just thoroughly depressed.
Yeah, right. You've actually managed to make me a bit depressed now.
Well, you know why? Because when somebody does become as iconic in death as much as life, you kind of don't actually know the little gritty details. You don't know how upsetting and stressful it is for her dad, actually.
No, you don't. You don't know how much she wanted children and wanted to be okay.
This book made her a real person.
Yeah.
And she lived her life as a real person throughout. She was never a celebrity.
Yeah, you're right.
And hearing her dad tell that story, it just really made you realise just how terribly upsetting the whole thing is. Mm. Do you know one of the saddest things, like selfishly, one of the saddest things about Amy Winehouse's death is that we never heard her Bond theme.
Oh, I didn't even know there was a Bond theme on the cards.
I knew she was kind of mooted to do it. I didn't realise how far down the line they'd got in recording. It sounds like it was almost done, doesn't
it? Yeah, they really had. And which one was it again?
Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, then I had to look that up. Chris Cornell did it. Oh, I think that's the dullest Bond theme that's ever.
Oh, no, you haven't listened. Listen to it again.
Okay, I'll listen to it again. But Amy Winehouse's Bond theme would have been a classic. What's sad again is that she was really excited to do it.
Yeah.
And then just in no fit state.
That's the thing, isn't it? The thing that made me think the whole situation was so hopeless is that she was actually doing work she was so entirely excited about still wasn't enough.
No.
Because the pull of the alcohol and her addiction.
Yeah, the addictions are stronger.
Yeah.
It's a damn tragedy. Addictions are crap.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes this book important, because lots of people idolise Amy. They need to read the reality of her addiction.
That's very true. Don't put her on a pedestal because she's this rock and roll cool person who died at 27 and went into... No, it's not cool at all. It's not fun. It's not fun for her.
It is weird, as a society in rock and roll mythology, we really idolise these people which have really dark periods in their life. They often succumb to addiction and they're essentially miserable, but somehow we turn those people into icons that to be admired and people want to be like them. It's like, no, you need to admire people with long careers who have survived, like Jane Fonda and her Keep
Diana
Fit tapes.
Yes.
We need to, that's who we should be idolising. Yeah. This is who we should be telling young people to idolise.
Well, nobody likes ageing, you see. If you die young, you're forever young. People love that.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, you can have plastic surgery now to look young. No, well, actually, so we do idolise people like Cher and Madonna who just keep going.
We do.
I just wish we could get the adulation away from these people who crashed and burned at a young age, because I don't think that's a good mindset for young people to be looking to.
No.
Do you know what I mean? We should be looking to the old grannies who keep on rolling.
Yeah, yeah.
Until they get to the point like Amy's grandmother, you know, oh, I've had enough.
I've had enough.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Thrift Shop Biography. We love making this podcast and we're absolutely thrilled that so many of you are already listening. You could really help us out by leaving us a review somewhere, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you could share us, tell your friends about us or drop some links on social media. We have a Facebook page called Thrift Shop Biography. So make sure you come over there to hear about the episodes first and what else we're up to. Okay, see you next week. And if you're new here, there are loads more episodes now to go and listen in the back catalogue. So make sure you go and enjoy them. Okay, thank you very much.